Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Sometimes it's like this. The major economic news of the week was that there really wasn't much news. We learned this morning wholesale inflation's no big deal. Another report on retail sales was mostly benign. The Fed did nothing on Wednesday with interest rates, as we all expected. There is the trade gap, of course, growing as always, but you know what? Congress and the White House have a plan to handle that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday today, everybody, May 11th. Great to have you with us. You know, bipartisanship's been in short supply in Washington, but late yesterday, the Democratic Speaker of the House and the Republican Secretary of the Treasury announced a deal on international trade. It is the first step toward congressional approval of trade agreements that have already been negotiated with four countries. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports business, labor, and environmental groups have been poring over the details all day.
With this deal, Republicans agree to minimum labor and environmental standards in trade agreements. In return, Democrats will sign off on lower trade barriers that have protected American industries and jobs from cheaper imports. The negotiating team included the top two members of the House Ways and Means Committee, Democrat Charles Rangel of New York and Republican Jim McCreary of Louisiana. McCreary says it's a significant breakthrough.
When the Democrats took over control of the House and Senate, I recognized that the trade agenda was in jeopardy because Democrats had become fairly well united in opposing any trade deals, most because they really wanted these labor protections and environmental protections inside the free trade agreements.
Several business groups today said they were satisfied the compromise will allow those protections without giving unions the ability to use trade deals to change U.S. labor laws. But as details of the agreement became available, some of the Capitol's strongest labor advocates began raising questions. North Dakota Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan had a message for negotiators who've been celebrating their compromise.
Let me just say to them that there's another voice here in this Congress, a voice that will come from the United States Senate, and there are some of us here that will insist that we stand up for the economic interests of this country.
And business support for the compromise is not unanimous. Some raise concerns the deal is a threat to U.S. environmental laws and would undermine patent protections on prescription drugs. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
All the action in Congress happened late, I guess. The House passed legislation in the wee small hours that will require an intelligence assessment on the national security risks posed by global warming. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
Lawmakers battled into the early morning over the Democrats' inclusion of a climate provision in the fiscal 2008 intelligence bill. Democrat Edward Markey, who heads the newly formed Global Warming Committee, recalled the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia as a stark reminder that climate change can fuel conflict.
Drought caused famine. Famine caused food relief. Food relief caused warlords to fight over it. The warlords fighting caused the U.S. to intervene, and 19 U.S. fighting men were killed.
Republicans tried to delete the provision on the grounds that it would be a waste of intelligence resources needed to fight terrorism. Peter Hoekstra of Michigan says global warming should remain under the auspices of scientists, not spies.
What do we expect to task our spies to do to get us a unique perspective on climate change?
This debate comes on the heels of a report issued last month by a panel of retired generals. It warns global warming's effects, like crop failures, could destabilize governments and create havens for terrorists. But international policy expert Scott Barrett with Johns Hopkins University says politics may be more at play here.
You're basically taking an issue that a lot of people have cared about for environmental and development reasons and turning it back to the Bush agenda for national security.
Which, he says, could force the conservative holdouts to take climate change more seriously. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Investors got back today most of what they lost yesterday. We'll have the details and we'll check in with that guy down in Dallas when we do the numbers. By way of introducing this next story, we direct your attention to Title II of the United States Code, also Titles 26, 18, 36, and 47. United States Code is the fancy way of saying the law of the land, the final versions of bills that Congress passes and the president signs. Each title is as thick as a telephone book, or thicker, and the ones that I mentioned are the ones that address, in some way, election law, the campaigning, and the financing. Rules for candidates running for federal office are notoriously opaque. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports that in some states, like Virginia, it's an entirely different story.
The federal campaign finance system comes complete with complicated giving limits, spending limits, outside expenditures, independent advocacy groups, and thousands of lawyers who make a living finding loopholes.
The federal system is so convoluted that I haven't met a reporter in 10 years that understood the law.
Ray Allen is a Republican political consultant based in Richmond, Virginia.
The reformers have not chased the money out of politics at the federal level. They've just chased it into different avenues and made it harder to track.
Allen says in Virginia, state campaigns are different. If you want to give $10 million to your best friend to pay for his or her entire campaign, that's cool. It's more than cool, it's legal. In Virginia, there are no limits on what a company, a union, or a rich friend can give to a politician running for a state office. There's just one hard, fast rule. All that money has to be made public.
It creates a rough justice. If you're taking money, then the people know you're taking it.
Allen says this system lets voters sort out what money is good and what just doesn't pass their sniff test. The consultant remembers when one of his client candidates got burned.
We took a $100,000 check from Pat Robertson. It took about 3 days for our opponents to be up on television telling you to hide your children and batten down the hatches because we were going to impose a theocracy.
But in Washington, D.C., lawyers and political consultants have spent years figuring out new and ingenious ways to funnel huge amounts of money into national politics, often obscuring where the money actually comes from. And these groups have begun to move into Virginia state politics. In 2005, a federally registered nonprofit called the Republican State Leadership Committee took sides in the state's race for attorney general. At the time, no one knew anything about where the group was getting its money. Democrat Creed Eads was the candidate on the wrong side of an avalanche of cash.
In the last month of that campaign, last 5 weeks, when that money was coming in, a chunk after chunk, and media buys were just more than I could keep up with.
Creed Eads helping criminals sue Virginia.
In just over a month, the group dumped more than $2 million into Deeds' opponent's campaign.
The Republican State Leadership Committee Virginia PAC sponsored this ad.
Today, police warned parents about a sexual predator.
Deed feels it cost him the election.
I'm awfully proud of the effort we made in light of the bombardment we were under. But, you know, the only thing that matters is at the end of the day, I lost.
By 360 votes. The Virginia Assembly has tried to shut down that kind of shadowy fundraising, but already new cracks are beginning to show. Politicians in Virginia have started forming federal nonprofits that accept unlimited donations and don't reveal their donors. And Virginia delegate Brian Moran recently pushed a law through the Assembly that would keep outsiders from raising money inside Virginia as a way to skirt their own state's laws. But Moran says,
you try to close one loophole, another loophole is created. It's kind of a lawyer's relief bill. You know, smart people figure out a way.
So for now, Virginians who believe in the Commonwealth's wide-open system of campaign fundraising will have to work to make sure it stays transparent. And with an army of lawyers just across the Potomac, they have their work cut out for them. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with Dallas stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Mr. Johnson, how are you?
Just fine. In fact, I found out something important about myself this week.
What's that?
Still nimble enough to dodge those bullets.
Yeah, I'll tell you, there were a couple of them hidden in there, weren't there?
Yeah, there were. This market, of course, everybody. This is the intriguing thing about the market is everybody thinks it's just a one way market, that it goes up and up and up and up and up and up, yeah. And then it's got to turn around and just go straight down like a rock. And the fact is, what happens in a lot of markets is the correction, that is to say, the profit taking, mm-hmm, after a run up isn't like that. I mean, it didn't just have to scare the bejeebers out of you. It's not like a Six Flags ride or something. it can be churning, yeah. They dump some stuff, and then the money, instead of leaving the market, comes back into other stuff. And that's kind of what we're seeing in everything. I mean, so you take out food and energy. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know oil is just taking, yep, us. And you look at that wholesale inflation, that producer price, mm-hmm, index, and it was unchanged.
Yep.
And then retail sales, you flatten that out, yeah, take out the autos, and it was?
Oh, I know.
Unchanged. And so what you have is, you don't have any runaway growth at the caps to keep the Fed up late at night worrying, mm-hmm, about. And you don't have any runaway inflation, which makes them stay up even later.
So
the bottom line is, the Fed needs to declare victory, walk away, and go fight another battle because they've won.
Well,
they just don't know when they've won.
Well, see, that's the problem, though. If they don't know when they've won, how are we supposed to know that they've won?
Well, that's why they're driving home from a hard week of counting money, and they're listening to Marketplace, and we're telling them, all right, guys, you won. Over. Right.
Let me get to that profit taking churn thing and yesterday. Did that worry you at all? Did you sweat a little bit?
Sure, because you never know if it's going to be the real thing or not. This, mm-hmm, one you could kind of see coming. They were looking for an excuse to do some selling. You had all these retail numbers out, mm-hmm, there, and they're kind of confusing. And they chose that as an excuse, I think, to do the selling. And that's really all it is it was an excuse. And retail is kind of weak. Mm-hmm. But overall, that's understandable. And there are, there are haves and there are have-nots. You got the airlines keep trying to raise fares. They can't get it to stick. But on the other side,
yeah,
I was out talking with the analyst meeting with Texas Instruments, mm-hmm, this week, and they said their profit margins were going to be better than expected. Stock went up, gave a lift to the market. Obviously, they've got pricing power. Some do, some don't.
That's interesting, because that's a phrase we haven't heard in a long time, pricing power.
I like that. You know what else I like?
What do you like?
Snarky.
Or snarky pricing
power.
If you
could just say one time, let's go to Dallas for that snarky stockbroker,
right, next week.
Johnson.
You got it. Ask and you shall receive. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend, Kai.
You too. Coming up, Mother's Day takes on new meaning.
When I took care of my own babies years ago, I felt vehemently that this work of bouncing and feeding and diapering was the hardest, most important work in the world. Since then, I've waitressed, catered, hauled manure, but I'm back again to the hardest work.
But first, let's do the numbers. After a plunge yesterday, the markets put on their climbing gear today. The Dow Industrials picked up 111 points, 0.8% to finish the day at 13,326. The Nasdaq pulled forward 28 points, 0.1% to end at 2562. The S&P 500 scrambled up 14 points, almost 1% to close at 1505. For the week, the Dow bulked up 0.4%. The Nasdaq shed 0.4. The S&P 500 edged forward 0.2%. Chicago was Wall Street's kind of town today. The Chicago Merck sang up 7.75%. That after it raised its bid for crosstown rival CBOT Holdings. That's the Chicago Board of Trade. The Merck's move came on the heels of a competing bid from global commodities giant Intercontinental Exchange. CBOT rose 3.8%. ICE added 4.25%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's happening Monday. The Senate takes up the Water Resources Development Act. Confessed Talibani David Hicks returns home to Australia after more than 5 years at Guantanamo Bay Prison. He still has to serve 9 months in Australia, and he's banned from speaking to the media for a year. And get out your pennies. The price of a first-class stamp rises 2 cents to 41 cents. I'm Jane Lindholm.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's got a new thing he's doing. He's on a tear to increase foreign direct investment in the United States, and it'll probably be something of an uphill fight because Americans are notoriously uneasy about foreign firms buying U.S. businesses. The brouhaha over Dubai Ports World is probably the best-known example of that. Detroit may well be the next target of overseas interest. We told you before about Chrysler probably being sold off by its German parent company. One of the leading bidders is a Canadian parts maker, Magna, which just yesterday announced it's taken $1.5 billion investment from a Russian tycoon with close ties to the Kremlin, a guy named Oleg Deripaska. Andres Oslund is a fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. Mr. Oslund, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Who is Oleg Deripaska?
One of the richest men in Russia, a 39-year-old, self-made, big businessman, engineer by education, and the biggest tycoon in aluminum in Russia and almost in the world, and also a big owner of automotive companies in Russia.
And is that what explains his interest in Magna International, the Canadian car firm, that auto firm he owns in Russia?
Indeed. He owns a lot of automotive factories in Russia. He's doing pretty well with them in terms of production, but the products are not very good. He needs better products from the West.
What then do you suppose would Magna's interest in him be? They've agreed to $1.5 billion stake in their company from him. Why might they be doing that?
Well, the most obvious reason is to export to Russia. Deripaska controls much of their part of the market in Russia. And Deripaska wants Western technology. And he has tried various means of getting it through joint ventures, but nothing has really worked out. So then he tries by buying a share of the company abroad instead.
Speculation, of course, has centered around Magna and its possible bid for Chrysler, the American and German car company. Do you think Mr. Deripaska wants part of Chrysler? Is that in this bargain at all?
It would make perfect sense. He needs a Western company that can help his Russian automotive companies. And Chrysler would fit the bill very well for him. And for Chrysler, it would, of course, be good to get a wonderful access to the very fast-growing Russian market.
Why have Russian companies been spreading throughout the world? They've been buying foreign corporations for a number of years now.
Well, they have built up splendid businesses, pretty much like the American robber barons slightly more than 100 years ago in this country. And commodity prices have been wonderful. And when you earn more money, then, of course, you want to expand. And where do you expand? You expand abroad.
Anders Oslund is a fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C. He was an economic advisor to the Russian government back in the 1990s. Mr. Oslund, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Vice President Dick Cheney and Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad are doing something of a Texas two-step to stay out of each other's way. The vice president was in Abu Dhabi yesterday seeking support for U.S. policies in the Middle East. President Ahmadinejad will be there this weekend looking for the same thing for his policies. There's a lot of diplomatic and economic pressure being brought to bear by both sides all over that region. To see how it's playing out on the ground, though, Lebanon's a pretty good place to start. That's where countries that want to show influence are financing the rebuilding after last summer's Israeli invasion. Ben Gilbert reports now on reconstruction one-upmanship.
As you drive from Beirut toward Lebanon's border with Israel, billboards let you know you're moving from a place of relative tolerance to the more conservative Shiite Muslim South. Alcohol ads and images of curvy models give way to the turbaned figure of Hezbollah chief Hassan Nasrallah. In some places, the leader of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, scowls down from signs on utility poles. It's no surprise when we see that the road we're traveling is being rebuilt after Israeli bombs chewed it up by an Iranian-owned contractor. A few miles down the road is Bint Jebail. This town was the backdrop for hundreds of television feeds showing the destruction from Israeli bombs. Now it's being completely reconstructed, not by Shiite Iran or Hezbollah or the Lebanese government, but by the largely Sunni Muslim Gulf Arab country of Qatar.
I don't know why, but thanks to them, you know.
From the government of Qatar, pay damages to those who are to repair their homes.
That's one happy person in an eager crowd gathered in the Bint Jebail mayor's office to find out how much he would be compensated for his damaged home. Qatar is spending $300 million on Bint Jebail and three other villages. They're rebuilding everything, 12,000 housing units, mosques, streets, and all the way down to school desks. Bint Jebail native and Detroit, Michigan resident Ali Faraj is grateful.
Qataris are friends of everybody. They just want to help the people, but the government didn't help us yet.
The Lebanese government has only distributed around 10% of reconstruction money for people's homes. The process has been slowed in part because foreign donors have pressured the government to be more transparent in the distribution of funds. Unfortunately, that's led to charges of corruption. And people in South Lebanon are so desperate for any cash that they don't care where it comes from, like Bint Jebail resident Zatzer Qasim.
We don't care about politics, you see? They are helping us. Anybody who helped us, we are thankful for him. If America came here, George Bush said, I will help the Lebanese people, we are with George Bush, you see? We are with him.
Around Lebanon, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of signs that say, thank you, Qatar. Other donors also tout their benevolence. France and the United Arab Emirates funded demining teams and temporary bridges and made sure people knew through billboards and signage. The U.S. adopted a high-profile bridge project in Lebanon's eastern mountains, and Raouf Youssef, the USAID director in Lebanon, says the agency is pouring money into South Lebanon.
The loss, if you don't work in South Lebanon, you're creating pockets of terrorists. You're creating pockets of areas very hostile to the Americans and don't understand us. We want to go there and let them understand us. Let us hear our message.
Sunni Arab states like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait want Lebanon's Shiites to hear their message too, as they try to stem Iran's growing regional influence. They also fear a conflict between their ally, the U.S., and their neighbor, Iran. Youssef says the Sunni reconstruction efforts aimed at Lebanon's Shiites are just part of a larger strategy.
I think the Sunni in the Arab world are really scared about the expansion of the Shiite influence in the region. There's no question about it.
Saudi Arabia and Kuwait both stand to lose if the Lebanese government's efforts don't pick up. They gave hundreds of millions of dollars directly to the government for reconstruction. Hezbollah says if the government can't help, it will step in and rebuild people's homes, which would likely be done with at least some funding from Iran. In Beirut, I'm Ben Gilbert for Marketplace.
Sunday's Mother's Day, so you've got 36 hours or so to scramble if you happen to have forgotten. It's a day when restaurants are packed with moms who don't want to cook that day, and when, maybe if you are a mom, you take some time for some special pampering. Nancy Olison's three kids are older now, but she's become kind of a mom again, relearning the value of that job.
Several months ago, my sister was diagnosed with brain cancer. So each weekend, I care for her six-month-old girl, Rose, and her two-year-old boy, Jens. At night, I settle the baby into a portable crib in our basement family room. A cooler with two bottles is next to my pull-out couch. I'm still winding down from work and a hectic supper. Now I have to zero in on this primal task. At 1 a.m., I change her diaper while she belts out her hunger cry. Sometimes I can't get her bottle at the right angle. We walk and bounce. I feel a familiar, desperate edge. Finally, she settles in for a 45-minute feeding. My neck cricks. I swaddle her. She's got my sister's face. I was 11 when my sister was a baby. I learned how to swaddle from swaddling this baby's mother. My stomach lurches in fear. We sleep thickly for 2, maybe 3 hours. Then we begin again. In the morning, I hear my teenage daughters upstairs helping Jens eat his oatmeal. Downstairs, a smile breaks across Rose's face. She wiggles her little body. She's radiant. I sing her a little song. Then I try brushing my teeth while holding her. Suddenly, she's crying, full on. I abandon my hygiene. We march upstairs. Do you want to try holding her? I half beg my 12-year-old. I feel bitter. Why do I have to do this? Then I feel horribly guilty. Then I'm angry. Why is my sister so sick? My 13-year-old sits with Jen, smearing jelly on his toast and answering, why is the light on? What's in my cup? Where's the doggy? When I took care of my own babies years ago, I felt vehemently that this work of bouncing and feeding and diapering was the hardest, most important work in the world. Since then, I've waitressed, catered, hauled manure, chaired the school board. Now I have a desk job, but I'm back again to the hardest work. I've stepped in out of love and guilt and financial necessity. My deep grief drives me forward. My fear simmers beneath. I focus on the childcare. I can do this. It's the best, most important work I'll ever do.
Nancy Olesen is a radio writer and producer in Minneapolis. Take a minute to send us your comments. Our website is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, British young people have some new musical idols, Bach and Brahms. UK Radio's Classic FM says its audience now boasts 500,000 young teens, almost 50% more than February. The marketplace players wish the great composers were around to take advantage of the new youth market.
This Saturday at Wembley Stadium, Classic FM presents Beethoven. The Madman of Vienna brings his demonic musical power to London for one night only. Screaming strings, roaring horns, and 10 pieces of heavy, heavy percussion. Beethoven! If it's too loud, you're not deaf. Beethoven rocks Wembley. It's gonna be classic. Ugh.
And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the markets got back some of what they lost yesterday. The Dow gained 111 points, 0.8%. The NASDAQ picked up 28 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 rose 14 points. That is almost 1% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, an unhealthy predicament for small businesses.
Many times entrepreneurs can't get health insurance because they're too high a risk. If you run a small business and you get rated just based on yourself or a few other employees, you may be out of luck finding affordable insurance at all.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.